Welcome. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Here on The Deep State, we go deep into stories that the mainstream media simply doesn't want you to know. The Deep State imprisoned me once upon a time. Well, now we're going after The Deep State. I want to bring on now Jackson Hinkle. Jackson is an American political commentator. He has one of the most engaged accounts on X in the entire world, and he's the host of the daily show Legitimate Targets on YouTube. So Jackson, you've become one of the most recognizable independent political commentators online. And I want to ask you a bunch of questions about it. So starting, I want to say that you do not have an ideology that is neatly defined in a little box. On Wikipedia, it shows that it's neatly defined in a little box, but that's just simply not true. So how would you describe your own ideology to someone who doesn't yet know you, but is intrigued by some of the things that you've said? How would you describe yourself?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I'll repeat again, I'm a huge fan of yours.
And, thank you, sir. The same way, same here. I'm a huge fan of yours.
I don't know what I'd do without all these stories. I mean, whether it's on TikTok or YouTube, I'm just inundated, and it's a beautiful thing. But I grew up in an apolitical household, and somewhere along the line, I started getting interested in politics and realizing all the different sorts of lies that were sold. Everyone knows what they are. And I started to really get interested in Marxist literature. So I am a Marxist-Leninist. I'm an American communist. But also with that, you know, I'm an American patriot. I'm an Orthodox Christian. These are all things that I think can properly describe who I am. And as a communist, some people hear that and they say, you know, by God, he doesn't look like he went to, you know, Berkeley or something, and he doesn't have blue hair. But John, you probably know better than just about anyone else that around the world, communism looks way different than it does in America. It's not this George Soros phenomena that we see in the United States. Communists are in many cases traditionalists. They can be radical. They are radical, of course, but not in the way we think of where people have like five different genders in the United States and they hate their country, right? Communists should love their country and be patriots.
Actually, my partner happens to be a communist. She was not born in the United States, and she practices the same kind of communism that you're talking about right now, where it's not doctrinaire ideological communism. It's a concern for the poor, for the downtrodden, for those whose civil and human rights are not respected. She happens to not be religious. You're an Orthodox Christian. I'm an Orthodox Christian. You could have different, you know, strains of communism. And overseas, pretty much anywhere, not in the United States, being a communist or saying that you are a communist is not something that is considered to be a dirty little secret. Yeah.
Yes. Do you
get pushback?
Of course we get pushback. But, you know, I think that people are more open-minded now than ever before about, you know, different ideologies or just different questions that are being asked, hearing different perspectives. And that's the beautiful thing, especially about Gen Z in this new digital era that we're living in, is so many eyes are being really open for the first time. And once they're open, you can't close them again. So it's not to say that, you know, all of my followers or even a large portion of them are communists. They're definitely not. But it's about creating a big tent of people from all political backgrounds that can unite against this Epstein regime on the liberal and, you know, conservative side. It's one big party, as we all know. But what is Washington, D.C. today?
Yeah, isn't that the truth? I want to ask you about foreign policy. And I hope you don't mind if I spend a little bit of time on foreign policy. This is a love of mine and one of my great interests. But you've taken some foreign policy positions that are almost in lockstep with mine. We may come to the same conclusions from different places, but we come to the same conclusions. So you have taken positions in support of Palestinians, for example. So have I. And before we started talking, I mentioned to you, I've been getting a lot of death threats. A lot. You know, at first I just blow them off, they're crackpots. I get maybe one a year, one every couple of years. Now I'm getting every couple of days, I'm getting death threats. And they've become very, very specific. They are always because of my position in support of Palestinian human rights. And on that, like you, I will never waver. Never. But they're very specific, like telling me, I can't wait to see your brains on the sidewalk in front of, and then they recite my home address. I went to see an A-list internationally known podcaster 2 weeks ago. And we've been friends for more than a decade. And he was wearing a bulletproof vest, and he had security in the office. In fact, I was introducing myself to everybody. Not introducing myself, I was saying hi to everybody around him. It's mostly young people. And there was a guy a little bit older than me, and I said, hi, I'm John. I shook his hand. And he said, oh, we've met. I said, oh, we have? Was it last time I was up here? He said, nope. It was in the safe house, 2002, Islamabad. And I said, oh, I remember you. I said, you were the guy. And he said, yeah, I was the guy. I said, what are you doing here? He said, I'm heading security. But this is how dangerous things have become since Charlie Kirk was killed. There are these allegations that maybe an ally of the United States was behind the murder of Charlie Kirk. We don't know. The FBI and the Utah State Police aren't releasing any information. But my point here is that people who have taken positions in support of Palestinian human rights are being described as extremists and anti-Semites and all kinds of terrible things, leading to death threats. What has your experience been? And why have you come out in support of Palestinian human rights? And that's not a rhetorical question. I mean it quite literally.
Well, that's an incredible story and just goes to show how serious everyone, I hope everyone is taking this matter, right? I hope you're taking it that seriously, given what you just told me. I hope that Tucker's taking it that seriously, because a lot of people would be very happy to see more horrifying things happen, like what happened to Charlie Kirk.
Yep.
To those who, again, just state the obvious that you can't, you can't just bomb an entire country with wanton disregard for civilian life. You can't just carpet bomb the place and turn it into a parking lot. But, you know, there's so many aspects to why I think people support the Palestinians or support any of the countries that are being targeted by U.S. or proxy aggression right now. And the way that I see it, it's twofold. I mean, of course, I feel as though our government is captured by big finance, by finance capital. I think it doesn't represent us, so on and so forth. And every single blow to the American empire, you know, especially abroad as it stretches its wings with these hundreds of military bases and all the operations that it carries out on a daily basis, I say that whoever does that, whoever strikes that blow, is a brother in the common struggle that I'm in to try and actually get a government that represents, you know, the needs of the working class of America. And it's obviously not to say that I would ever support terrorism, against our government or something like that. But it's just these are sovereign struggles that people are waging to try and safeguard their homelands. And that's the other aspect here, because in the same way that, you know, most people, I'm beginning to see that some people can't recognize this basic fact anymore. But in the way that most people understand that, for example, child sexual abuse is horrific and disgusting and demonic and, you know, the worst thing that you could ever imagine, because on so many levels, but of course, at its core, you are stripping a child of its potential for living a life that has some sort of meaning, a life that has some sort of hope. You're stripping that away from a child. That's exactly what the U.S. is doing to all of these countries, all of these innocent people all across the world. They're stripping away their right to live some sort of a meaningful life with hope that things could get better. And yeah. I think that's horrific, and I think it's terrifying that this has been normalized.
Why do you think we have different rules for different countries. And I'll tell you what pops into mind immediately, you just raised it, is this Israeli government official who was arrested for a child sex crime in Las Vegas, I don't know, 6-8 months ago. And the next thing you know, before the guy can even be arraigned, he's on a plane back to Israel. Why? Because Israel does not extradite Jews for any reason. And he got off scot-free. Now, just yesterday or the day before yesterday, another Israeli government official was arrested in the United States for a child sex crime. We should not expect that there will be justice in that case. Why do we put up with things like this? What is it about the Israelis that they have such a hold on us?
Well, I think you're in the position to answer that question better than I am. But, you know, you just laid out a perfect example about the individual who threatened you over standing up for Palestinian rights. And, you know, we're just commentators. Of course, we, you know, I've been threatened. You've been threatened. You know, before the Iran war started, I was trying to organize a group of people to go out to Iran and just like document what's going on in the lead up to what we assumed all to be was going to be a major war. And I received word through a trusted individual that I know and is, you know, very high up and whatnot that, you know, not because of me necessarily, but because the people we're trying to bring to this trip to Iran, the war is about to begin, and Israel and the United States would love to have the opportunity to accidentally, you know, launch atomic Tomahawk missile in our direction or something. So that trip got canceled.
Yeah.
I think it's primarily due to blackmail. I mean, how else could you describe it, right? I mean, you brought up Charlie Kirk. Of course, we don't have, you know, rubber stamp proof of, you know, someone in Israel did something or they were somehow involved. We have a lot of ancillary details that we can look at that are very concerning. But same could be said about other leaders in American history who've been assassinated. You could look at USS Liberty, for example, and really the fallout of that. There's too many instances to count, yeah. And you just don't see that with other countries.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's just not a thing, whether it's an adversary or a supposed ally. Sure, you may have pushback, like with Ukraine, but the level of which we see that pushback or the threats, it's nowhere near to the level we see with Israel.
Yeah, that's so true. There are a couple of things that bother me very much. One is that if you are not in lockstep politically with Benjamin Netanyahu, not with Israel, with Benjamin Netanyahu specifically, you're an anti-Semite. And the Israelis have gotten to the point where they describe everybody as an anti-Semite. I've got a close friend who's an American citizen now, but he had been born and raised in Israel. He served in the IDF. He was in special forces, married an American, moved to the United States. And he told me that they're taught in schools as they're growing up to accuse everybody who doesn't agree with Israel of anti-Semitism. And I said to him, you know, that's probably the biggest engine for anti-Semitism that's out there. You can't accuse everybody of being anti-Semitic, including Semites. They accuse Palestinians all the time of being anti-Semites, and they are the original Semites, practically, or among the original Semites. So anyway, that's one thing. The other thing is open interference in American politics and American elections. I was on Capitol Hill the other day, and I'll tell you, very few things make me as angry as when I went to, for example, the office of Senator Tom Cotton, the conservative Republican from Arkansas. He has an Israeli flag in the hall outside his office. Now, can you imagine if somebody had a Russian flag, or even in my case, a Greek flag? We would be accused of, you know, espionage or not being patriotic or whatever. But you put an Israeli flag and then people salute it. We have a congressman from Florida who went onto the floor of the House of Representatives wearing an IDF uniform to show his solidarity with Israel. You know, a lot of these things to me would seriously call into question the patriotism of our elected officials. Lindsey Graham, probably my least favorite elected official on Capitol Hill for a whole bunch of reasons. said just a couple of days ago that until he draws his last breath, he said his last breath will be in support of Israel. Well, how about in support of America? Like, has that even occurred to you? I'm mystified by this attitude on Capitol Hill. Why? It didn't used to be like that. You know, I'm reading a book right now about John Kennedy and his interactions with the Israelis, especially around the nuclear issue. And John Kennedy was very upset with the Israelis. The Israelis were very upset with John Kennedy and may have played a role in his demise. We don't know. Lyndon Johnson was afraid of the Israelis. And then Richard Nixon guaranteed Israeli security for the first time in history. Guaranteed it. And nothing has been the same ever since. Is there any going back from that?
Well, you bring up the example of how being a, you know, what would effectively be described as an agent of the state of Israel, that's non-existent. You know, you can't be expected to receive however many hundreds of thousands of dollars from the state of Israel or their foreign ministry or media apparatus, and then someone asking you to go register under FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act. That's just not going to happen, at least in 99% of the cases. Maybe there's a few outliers. But, you know, it's like, I think it should go even beyond that. If someone was working for the North Koreans, I don't think it's a matter of whether or not they did or did not register under the Foreign Agents Act as to whether or not they'd avoid any sort of criminal investigation. I think if you are getting paid by the North Koreans, you know, you're going to have a pretty lengthy file on you investigation, and probably yes, you're going to be prosecuted because we don't even allow American citizens with passports in good standing to enter into North Korea at this point in time, thanks to Trump under his first administration. I think that's where the policy should be with the Israelis. I mean, this is a terrorist state that's committing a genocide in Gaza, that wants it and is working to annex the West Bank. They are committing war crime after war crime, not just in the south of Lebanon, not just cutting it off and occupying it yet again, but trying to target Beirut as much as they can without receiving any sort of slap on the wrist from the United States. And now Iran. And now I'm hearing from my Iraqi friends, I'm seeing these photos of, you know, some exploded military assets in Iraq. They've got some sort of a military base in Iraq. I know Max Blumenthal was just on Jimmy Dore's show talking about it. I don't even know what that's about, but I'd imagine maybe in Erbil. I don't know. I could be wrong about that. But it's like, this is a legitimate terrorist government. North Korea, okay, maybe you find them scary, but like, what are they doing? Did they just slaughter 200,000 plus civilians in a neighboring state? No. Why are we treating our so-called enemies as these horrifying pariahs that no one can ever even talk to? But then with Israel, there's no rules whatsoever. It's sickening. So yeah, I think I agree with you. These sorts of policy changes need to be the first steps. Obviously, JFK and RFK tried to do that. And then magically, after JFK was assassinated and then Bobby tried to run for president, he got assassinated in California. That policy is never talked about again, of registering the Israel lobby as a foreign agent in the United States.
No, it's not talked about again. I want to ask your opinion on something, too. I've said on a bunch of podcasts that starting around 1986, when Ronald Reagan was president, literally every single Israeli prime minister who would come to Washington would ask every president, Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden, they would ask every single president, please bomb Iran, please bomb Iran, please bomb Iran. And every single president said no. In fact, Barack Obama, and it's like a kick in my gut to have to compliment Barack Obama. But Barack Obama said a couple of weeks ago that when Benjamin Netanyahu came and Obama was president and he said, please bomb Iran, Obama said no. Netanyahu said, if you don't bomb Iran, I'm going to use nuclear weapons against Iran. And Obama said, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm not going to stop you. Go ahead and use nuclear weapons. And, of course, it was a bluff. Well, the conventional wisdom is that Netanyahu came back earlier this year and asked Donald Trump, bomb Iran. Trump said no. He said, if you don't bomb Iran, I'm going to use nuclear weapons. Trump said yes. And now here we're involved in a war that we can't win. Do you think that that narrative is true? Do you think that the Israelis bullied us and threatened us? And the reason why I ask is this. Just recently, Donald Trump declared a ceasefire in Lebanon, right? And as soon as he declared it, the Israelis bombed Lebanon again. And it just seems to me that the Israelis do whatever they want, whenever they want, knowing that the United States will never push back. Do you think that's true, number one? And number two, why and how did the Israelis get away with that?
Well, I think to answer quickly, I think, yeah, that is true to a certain extent. I mean, I think Israel and the U.S. probably have different goals in Lebanon in particular. As I understand, the U.S. is building like the largest consulate or one of the largest consulates or embassies in the world right now in Beirut. So I don't know, but maybe the U.S. would prefer stability. Clearly, this idea of trying to kill off Hezbollah didn't work. That didn't work at all. I mean, look at how strong they are. And it's not even about the missiles anymore. It's about the drones, how quickly they can produce them, how cheap. And they're pretty skilled operators for such a short period of time using these FPV drones and hitting high-value targets. But I think, I'm sure that Israel acts without any sort of regard for U.S. requests or anything like that. But on the flip side, I do believe that the Iran war has been made out into a single narrative, that being that Netanyahu forced us into this, and it kind of absolves Trump of any sort of real wrongdoing or any sort of power that he himself has to make that decision. As you mentioned with Obama, if that story happens to be true, I mean, that goes to show that you, as the president, you do have the capacity to make a decision. You do have the capacity to make certain threats. If they can threaten you, you can threaten them right back. Yeah. And I think it boils down to the simple fact that the U.S. has wanted this war for decades and decades. And now, you've got proxy war against Russia, which is a mess. You've got millions and millions of dollars of weapon shipments to Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And Iran, if you just look at it from the U.S. perspective, the DOE is going to be very happy. All the Gulf states get nerfed, and the oil industry there goes, you know, through the floor. And American oil companies in the long term, I think, will benefit from that. You look at the geopolitical analysis. Well, if you balkanize Iran into a dozen micro states where there's going to be terrorism all over the place, it's going to turn into some Syria 2.0. That's going to cause problems for Russia and the South. And also, one of the discussion points has been whether or not the U.S. is going to invade. And I don't really know if I believe this whole Karg Island story. That seems like a very difficult operation. I think it'd be more likely that, you know, I'm no expert, but it seems likely that they would target Chabahar in the South, in the Southeast.
Yeah.
And if they target that, and they get the local Baluchi people on their side, which I don't think they'll do, but that cuts off Iran from Afghanistan and Pakistan, which cuts off China's Belt and Road Initiative. So,
and keep in mind, too, I'm sorry to interrupt you, keep in mind that the Baluchis are generally Sunni Muslims, even though they are in majority Shia Iran. In that part of southeastern Iran and southwestern Pakistan, southern Afghanistan, they're Sunni Muslims. And there's already a separatist movement there, the Baluch People's Army. So I think you're right. If they really wanted to stir up trouble, that's where they're likely to do it.
Yeah, and even Netanyahu, I think, understands all this stuff. When he went to the United Nations, it was the UN General Assembly he went to, he held up those two signs that said, the curse and the solution or something.
Yeah.
And the curse was just China's Belt and Road Initiative. The solution was the India something corridor to Europe, where it goes through Israel.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of motives here, but I think to say that it's all Israel's fault is missing the mark.
thank you very much for being with us today. That was our guest, Jackson Hinkle. And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State, and remember, keep asking the questions that the government wants you to ignore. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.